It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, our guest says organic farms may not be as good for the environment as their supporters hope. We'll dive into the pros and cons coming up next. First, 2020 marks the 100th anniversary of women getting the right to vote at the national level. It was a long battle to get there, and many of the 19th century suffragists did not live to see the result of their years of work. The fight for an equal rights amendment to the U.S. Constitution began soon after. Decades later, that led to its passage in Congress and an effort to ratify the bill in the states. While the initial effort to pass the ERA in 38 states failed to make the deadline in 1979 and then an extended deadline in 1982, the effort hasn't stopped. Just last week, both houses of Virginia's legislature passed the Equal Rights Amendment. Tracy Thomas is the Cyberling Chair of Constitutional Law at the University of Akron School of Law and director of the Center for Constitutional Law established by Congress. She's the editor of the Gender and the Law Prof blog. Tracy, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, take us back about 100 years after the amendment giving women effectively the right to vote at the federal level and the first steps toward this Equal Rights Amendment.
Well, the Equal Rights Amendment was really the idea of Alice Paul. Alice Paul had been the suffrage leader that really pushed the 19th Amendment over by finally adopting militant tactics of picketing the White House and putting up signs calling out President Wilson. And that kind of theater and theatrics finally led to the 19th Amendment. But what she realized was that it only provided one right, the right to vote. And the original right to vote had been thought about in 1848 from Elizabeth Cady Stanton in Seneca Falls, New York, had 18 different equality rights demanded. So instead of going piecemeal through each of the remaining 17 rights, Paul said it's time for an equal rights amendment, one constitutional amendment that will guarantee equality in all of these civil and social rights.
Can you give us a sense of the sort of things that included?
Yeah, it was really everything that you might think of that would touch a woman or an individual's life. And so they were family rights, the right to divorce, the right to custody of children, the right to marital property, the right to sue or leave a marriage for domestic violence. They were the rights to the workplace, the right to education, the right to equal profession, the right to equal employment, equal pay. And then also more because the church was very involved in the Quaker women, very involved in the early suffrage movement, the right to equality in the church, the right to be a pastor or a minister, the right to speak equally in churches, because she saw the church as one of the main perpetuators of inequality norms that were underlying all of these laws.
Now, decades later, this starts to come to fruition in the late 60s and early 70s. What was the lead up to Congress tackling the ERA and actually passing it to pass it on to the states? Talk about that run up to get passed in Congress.
Yeah, it was a long run up. It took from 1923 till, as you said, sort of the early 1970s. And there was really just a lot of politicking going on. The Equal Rights Amendment from Paul was originally associated with pro-business interests. It was the Republican Party and pro-business interests and professional women that initially gravitated to the ERA. Because the concern from labor, which was the main opposition, labor union, consumer advocates, was that an equality amendment would prohibit workplace safety laws, maximum hour laws, and minimum wage laws, which they were trying to enact to protect women. And that most women, they said, were working women and needed these protections. And they didn't want an equal rights amendment that really, they said, would create equality to be treated terribly. So we had many decades where it was really the ACLU opposed the Equal Rights Amendment because they were pro-union and pro-labor. Eventually, we get federal legislation that enacts those kinds of worker protectives across the board coming out of Roosevelt's New Deal. And so those political animosities pass. And then everybody, both Republicans and Democrats, there's a lot of consensus and approval of the ERA, but it doesn't really get momentum until the civil rights movement, when we get racial civil rights, we get Vietnam, we get social protest, and we get sort of the final political push to get it through and to finally start having the debates and the votes.
We are talking to Tracy Thomas from the University of Akron School of Law, looking at the Equal Rights Amendment, talking about it now because the state of Virginia, its legislature just voted to ratify this. Let's talk about that ratification effort, Tracy. A lot of momentum early on, right?
In Virginia, you're talking about, right?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. In the country as a whole now, in the early 70s.
Oh, yes, in 1970. Well, in the 70s, yes, there was momentum, but there was also backlash. We often see both of those things accompanying any kind of movement for civil rights. And when we had the Equal Rights Amendment initially passed, it seemed like a pretty easy thing, right? Because as I said, we had both political parties, we had women of many different groups. And within the first year, many states, I think it was 30 or something, almost passed the Equal Rights Amendment right away. But then we get Phyllis Schlafly, we get the backlash, we get the rise of the Eagle Forum and the conservative movement that redefined what the Equality Amendment was about and said that really what ERA was going to threaten would be abortion, women being drafted, same-sex bathrooms, and equal rights for gay people. And so the concern was that sort of redefined the narrative and started to get concerns about family protectionist and the downfall of the family. And so it really stalled a lot of the debate that had seemed sort of self-evident, that this was sort of a pro forma, very formalistic thing. We already knew women should be equal, and was there really an argument? And it became very caught up in a lot of other issues, which ultimately led to the downfall.
Let's give a listen to Phyllis Schlafly, as you said, one of the most vocal opponents of the Equal Rights Amendment, talking here in 1972.
Women should not be equal to men. I think under our present system in the United States, women enjoy a very wonderful status. I think it's better than equality. I think women would be sacrificing many of the good things they now have, and it would be taking a step downward to go for equality.
Can you talk more about the role that Phyllis Schlafly and that philosophy she just outlined played in stopping that momentum in the Equal Rights Amendment?
Well, it raised concerns that equality would somehow threaten the family. And that's been the concern that in the mid-1800s was the same thing that was raised with concern to the vote. I mean, she's talking about women having a higher status. She's really talking about upper-class women, stay-at-home mothers who were protected by alimony laws and marital property laws and things that allowed her to remain protected in the home, which is a very Victorian kind of ideal and something that we saw. But those ideas started to resonate with people, right? I mean, there was opposition to the draft in general. So the idea that you would start to have a military draft for women was concerning. There was opposition to the changing roles of women. Not only we saw the advent of birth control pill and sexual freedom, and we saw the advent of women in the workplace and finally in significant numbers by the late 70s. And so there were concerns that things were changing, that regular families, regular norms were changing, and that was threatening to people. And then the insertion of the abortion issue then garnered the evangelical and the religious support, which then really changed the debate to a different question.
One of the most visible supporters of the ERA and the feminist movement was Gloria Steinem. Here she is. This is talking in 2011, looking back at her own realizations in the early years of the women's rights movement.
As a child, I just assumed that you could do anything. I didn't have brothers. I had an older sister. It didn't occur to me that there was a profound difference until I was 12 or 13, because that's the time at which the feminine role sort of comes down upon you like the Iron Maiden. You pretty much had to get married, have children, take your husband's name, assume his identity. So I assumed that I would have to marry the man I wanted to become. There was not really a choice, and it was the beginning of the women's movement that made me realize, wait a minute, we do have a choice.
But that, compared to what you just said about and what we heard from Phyllis Schlafly, Gloria Steinem welcoming those kind of changes, and some women, again, like Phyllis Schlafly, fearing those kind of changes.
Exactly. And I think at least our polls tell us that when you ask people just the simple question, do you believe in equality for women? Almost everybody says yes. I mean, the thought that women should not have an equal right to a place in a college or a medical school or a law school or an employment or the old days from the 1970s of help wanted ads listed by male and female. So a woman couldn't even apply for certain jobs. I mean, most people don't have any objection to that. And frankly, polls also show us that most people think the ERA is actually passed, that gender equality is in the Constitution. Although it's in our common law, constitutional law, it has not been enshrined in the Constitution. So there's this tension that people assume that equality, and they seem to back that. And that is what has been driving the ERA, and what's really driven the resurrection of it is that these are really fundamental truths that most people really hold true, is that there is this inherent equality and that people and women believe in the right to have that equal freedom and autonomy to live their lives in the same way as men.
We're talking to Tracy Thomas right now, Chair of Constitutional Law at the University of Akron School of Law, Director of the Center for Constitutional Law. We're talking about the history and future of the Equal Rights Amendment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you remember when the ERA was passed and ratified here in Wisconsin in April 1972? Were you for it or against it then? How about now? We'll talk about what's going on today and the future of the Equal Rights Amendment. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Tracy Thomas. She's Chair of Constitutional Law at the University of Akron School of Law. We're talking about the history and future of the Equal Rights Amendment after Virginia ratified it last week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the U.S. should have ratified the Equal Rights Amendment by its deadline, 1979 or 1982, after the deadline was extended? Would you want to see it brought back today, as Virginia has started to do? Do you think that there are inequalities that need to be addressed one way or another between men and women, whether it's through laws in Congress or at the state level or through this constitutional amendment? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tracy, let's bring things up to this month now. Virginia ratifies the Equal Rights Amendment. They vote in favor of it. What does this mean now?
Well, Virginia is the magic state because it was magic number 38. This modern movement began back in 2017 when Nevada became the first of the recent three to come back to the ERA and come back to a vote on ratification. Illinois followed in 2018, and now Virginia. But Virginia is the one that makes it 38. And 38 is the number of states that you need to ratify a constitutional amendment. We need 3/4 of the state. And so now the question is, we actually have the 38 states. Now, we may need to argue about whether there is a deadline and what are there technicalities, are there procedures, are we allowed to do that? But we at least have the political result that we know that over a period of time, there is the consensus that this should be an ERA. And so that really changes everything. That really at least changes it from an open political question to a political question that's hard for those in Congress to ignore, and really gets us into more technicalities and even questions about who's supposed to resolve that, whether that would be the courts or whether that should be left to Congress.
Well, let's talk about that deadline. Congress, as I understand it, when they voted to send this to the states, they set this countdown clock, and we didn't get in under that count, so isn't it over at that point?
Well, the argument, there's actually several arguments. There's an argument that, first of all, that Congress should not have put a deadline in. That's probably a harder argument, but the first 17 amendments to the Constitution did not have deadlines. The 18th Amendment on Prohibition became the first one to actually use a deadline. That has been the common practice. And so the Supreme Court has said that Congress may create deadlines. So then the second argument is, well, if they can create them, then they can waive them or remove them and extend them. So if Congress had that right, that Congress now could, for example, say, well, we're going to nullify or waive that deadline. They could also say, we'll extend it to 2020. And so if by either one of those that would require a vote now by Congress, but at least that would continue the power. And the reason the precedent for that is another Supreme Court case on the Child Labor Amendment, which obviously was not ratified. But in that case, that amendment did not have a deadline. But the Supreme Court said that Congress comes back to a decision after the 38th state and decides whether too much time has gone by or not. And so that's precedent to say, well, that's where we are. We now have 38 states. And so does Congress have the ability to say, has too much time gone by? And the precedent, again, is the 27th Amendment. The 27th Amendment, which is about whether Congress can enact itself and its own pay raise or whether pay raises have to be for the future, was actually one of the original Bill of Rights proposed. It would have been the Second Amendment. Obviously, it didn't pass, but it passed 200 years later. So the 27th Amendment did not have an express deadline, but it had almost 200 years of pending. So that's the authority to suggest that Congress has the ability to at least ignore, waive, redo this deadline now at this point.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Adams. Chris, hi.
Hi. I have a constitutional question because I brought a federal lawsuit under Title IX, and I had a horrible time going through it because there was such precious little case law. The question I have is, does the ERA have jurisdiction over higher education and Title IX, and is it going to reinforce the law so that people like me don't have to go through what we went through trying to find an attorney and get something done about this?
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. So equal rights protections passed by Congress, which exists under Title IX, versus the ERA, which isn't in effect.
Well, they're kind of two different laws, and Title IX deals with equality in education. So it deals with equal rights of women as students and women as student athletes. But an ERA, the hope is that a constitutional amendment really raises up the level of gender equality at every level, so that it becomes a foundational norm that says gender equality cannot be denied. And so that may change the way that we have been looking at other laws and other, not necessarily statutes, but other laws. For example, in most of our constitutional law with gender equality, courts use what's called intermediate scrutiny, which is they don't look at them as closely as they do statutes and laws based on race. And so some discrimination based on sex gets through. An equal rights amendment would change that. It would change it to the highest level of scrutiny, which would allow less discrimination than there is now. So that kind of a foundational norm would probably read into our existing understanding and interpretations of the existing statutes, including Title IX.
Chris, thanks for that call. We're talking to Tracy Thomas from the University of Akron School of Law, looking at the Equal Rights Amendment, past, present, and future. One more technicality I understand is out there, Tracy, is yes, Virginia is the 38th state to ratify, but a few states have voted to withdraw their approval of the Equal Rights Amendment. Is that right? And if so, what effect does that have?
Yes, there were five states that rescinded their ratification early on, before that last deadline. And several of those have now brought a lawsuit seeking to stop the National Archivist, who technically makes the amendments law, from accepting those ratifications. That is an open question. We have not really addressed this, but we do have some precedent again here. In the 14th Amendment, the Civil Rights Amendment with equal protection and due process, one of the key Civil War Reconstruction amendments, there were several states that rescinded their ratification of the 14th Amendment. And Congress and the National Archivist refused to accept those rescissions. So when we've had this before, there is not an ability to rescind because it's sort of a one-way street. Once you're walking down this amendment process, once the Congress puts the amendment forward, it can't take it back. Once a state ratifies it, it's irrevocable. We have that word, irrevocable trust, irrevocable laws. And so our precedent, at least the one example that we have, suggests that you can't rescind.
What happens now then?
Well, there's a lot of different strategies. This lawsuit that was filed by three attorney generals of Alabama, Louisiana, and South Dakota is attempting to sort of preempt, to control the next step, which is a lawsuit asking, again, that the archivist not include these rescinded votes, which would mean that we wouldn't have 38. And that raises a lot of questions about, there is also a question from this past case that I was describing about whether any of these questions should belong in the courts of law or whether it's up to Congress. So the Department of Justice weighed in just a few weeks ago, Office of Legal Counsel, with an opinion saying that it found that the deadline had expired and that in its opinion, the National Archivist should not record those the final votes. So the archivist is really just a record keeper. You know, he's keeping track of Virginia and all of these votes. But normally the 38th vote is there and it would be reported back to Congress. So there will be there could be several things. We look like we have a lawsuit happening on one front. There should be some congressional action now on the other front to see where does that amendment go and will Congress now act upon it in some way.
Tracy, thanks a lot for being with us today.
I was glad to be here. Thank you.
Tracy Thomas is the chair of constitutional law at the University of Akron School of Law and director of the Center for Constitutional Law established by Congress. She was with us today to talk about the history and future of the Equal Rights Amendment with Virginia's passage of the bill last week. Coming up after the news, you might love organic produce, but is it good for the environment? We'll talk about research that shows small organic farms might not be the best solution for agriculture's environmental problems. By the way, join us tomorrow evening at 7 for live coverage of Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers' State of the State Address. That'll be hosted by Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson and PBS Wisconsin's Frederica Freiberg. Plus, we'll hear Wisconsin State Senator Roger Roth with this year's Republican response. That's tomorrow at 7 here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Sexual assault investigations within the Wisconsin National Guard are going to get a second look from the state. We'll find out who's going to review them and why coming up. First, a lot of people like organic produce. Maybe they think it's fresher or tastes better, or maybe they think it's better for the environment. On that last point, some research is starting to suggest that small organic farms may not be the solution for environmental problems in agriculture. Nathaniel Johnson is a senior writer at Grist. Nathaniel, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, great to be here.
Well, a lot of people think organic farming equals better for the environment. What are some of the concerns being raised about that idea?
This is a really tricky one to communicate because, you know, even the name organic suggests just naturally arising from the environment. But, you know, we got to keep in mind that all farming requires pushing nature to do something that it wouldn't do on its own. And so when you look at the totality of the studies, it's hard to find a real environmental benefit comparing organic to conventional agriculture.
And a big story at the heart of this is how much land are we using to get the food we eat? How are people trying to shake that out and compare organic to what we call conventional farming?
So, that's really the trick. I mean, organic farming, there's the evidence when you look at just a single piece of land, right? Organic farming tends to have some real benefits there. But because it's producing less food per acre, those benefits can get watered down when instead you're looking at the unit of food. So if you're choosing between one food or another food in the supermarket, what you really want to do is look at, you know, how much land does this take up? Because in terms of farming, the biggest impact on the environment is the amount of land that it's occupying. If we converted entirely to organic agriculture, the calculations suggest that we need about, and we didn't change anything else, we need about the area of Argentina to add in as more farmland under the plow. And so that has a really big impact on the climate and biodiversity and a lot of other things.
Now, it's not a total negative for organics. There are some ways that you and others have talked about that small-scale organic farming is beneficial, maybe in particular locations for that matter. Can you talk about some of the upsides that people are mostly agreeing on?
Yeah, so this goes back to, again, are you looking at it by the unit of land or by the unit of food? So if you're making a decision about one particular piece of land, and you know, okay, we've got to do farming here. We're not going to dedicate this to wildlife. This is important to this community that there's a farm here, but it's right next to, say, a wilderness preserve, or it's right next to some endangered insect. Well, there's a real benefit to doing organic farming there, because organic farms tend to put less pressure on, you know, insect species. They're using often less insecticides, and so there's a little bit more biodiversity on that particular unit of land. It could provide a sort of buffer, and you know, often people want something like that close to them too. So you could imagine, you know, around cities, you might want more organic farms as well.
Talking to Nathaniel Johnson, senior writer at Grist, talk about how researchers are trying to balance the environmental costs and benefits of converting to organic agriculture. Not always easy to sort out. Nate, I've seen some researchers say, as you said earlier, the cost in land of switching completely to organic agriculture would be bad news. It'd be more harm than good. But they may argue it's good that we have organic, because they're trying some new things that then percolate over into the rest of the agricultural system. They're kind of like a test lab that we're learning things from, even if we don't want to go all organic. Do you see a case to be made there?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, what organic essentially is doing, it's placing some restrictions on farmers, and that forces those farmers to innovate in some interesting and different ways. And so we get some new ideas, we get some new techniques, and we've already started to see that happen in some interesting ways. And it's going to be really interesting. You know, we still don't know exactly how to get carbon into the soil. There's all this idea that we can suck up carbon in the plants and get it stored in the soil. And the evidence there is still real. You know, we've studied the first 30 centimeters of soil, and you get deeper than that and some important things happen, but we just don't have any studies on that. And so having some alternative systems to show what works and what doesn't in different climates and under different systems of agriculture will really help us figure things out.
You know, something I probably should ask you right at the outset: we hear organic and we assume a lot of things, but organic actually has a fairly specific meaning, at least as regulated in U.S. agriculture. What does it mean to be organic?
Well, there is a very specific meaning. There's a big PDF that you can read to explain all the different things. But just to put it simply, there's basically some suggestions for farmers about conserving the soil, about using pesticides as little as possible, and then when they do use pesticides, to use only from an approved list, you know, things that like copper sulfate or some oil products that like smother insects. So basically a preference for less engineered, less high-tech products and processes.
But hypothetically, somebody could be doing something in agriculture that is a net environmental gain, or trying to be a gain, when it comes to global warming or other impacts, but not be organic. There could be other ways to tackle the issues we want without being under that organic label. Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely. And I think that, if you wanted to really optimize and maximize, you probably wouldn't choose organic. You'd say, okay, I want to be as efficient as possible and maximize the amount of food that I can get off this particular amount of land, but use whatever techniques and tools it takes to get there. If I can maybe use a synthetic pesticide that's not allowed under organic, but I just use it very surgically and I just use it, there's some of these pesticides that target very precisely specific species, and just use a tiny bit rather than, using a lot of an oil or something like that that might target more species. You could see where you could really narrow in, and there are farmers that are doing this. The trick is we don't have anything like that codified into law or labeled with a brand that consumers can pick from.
And that seems like a really key point, the consumer side of this, because if you're at a grocery store and you see, one thing that says organic, one thing that doesn't, okay, you could see that. But if you're saying, hey, consumer, try to figure out the net, carbon impact of this piece of produce versus that one. Right. It's really hard. So how do we start to do this in a way that makes sense to consumers?
Well, I think it's absolutely impossible to like go through and decode the entire supply chain of this international economy. I think the answer is to make it so that there's no other choice but things that are environmentally friendly, and that's, we see some signs of this happening where environmental groups are sort of bullying / teaming up with some of the giant agricultural traders and saying, look, you've got to take these best practices and make sure they're happening around the world. And it's interesting. It's happening in some places. It's happening with certain commodities. And you don't have to get that many people on board because there's this real bottleneck in the number of traders in the middle that kind of move grains from one continent to another. So if you can get those giant majors on board, and we're starting to see this, like for instance with palm oil, there's real pressure. It's very hard to be a real unsustainable palm oil producer now and sell products into the global market and back to the United States. So there is some hope that this could really be happening.
Now, what are some, as we wrap up, Nate, what are some changes that you're watching for to see whether or not they're going to happen when it comes to agriculture and the environment?
Well, just examples like that. I mean, things are not great right now with, Brazil was the real success story with we really, through these kinds of initiatives, reined in the destruction of the Amazon rainforest. And now under Brazil's new president, we've seen that reaccelerate. And some of these big producers feel like they can't stand up to them. They'll just get kicked out of the country and won't be able to compete if they force farmers to stop cutting the rainforest down. So that's one I'm really watching carefully to see, will the international community be able to push back on that? And then closer to home, there's some really interesting ways in which farming in the U.S. is cleaning up its act with cover crops and filtering out nitrogen and phosphorus that otherwise would go down into the Gulf of Mexico and Lake Erie. That's still very small, but there's some signs that it's maybe on an exponential curve that could really make a big difference.
Nathaniel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Nathaniel Johnson, senior writer at Grist. He was with us today to talk about sustainable agriculture. He says it's more than just organic or not. Coming up, we'll find out why the State Department of Justice is going to review sexual assault investigations inside Wisconsin's National Guard. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, if you want to measure animal life in the rainforest, the best way to do it may be to just listen. We'll talk to a UW researcher about her work in the field of bioacoustics. Now, the Wisconsin Department of Justice says it's going to look into sexual assault investigations in the National Guard. The Guard conducted its own investigation of cases in recent years, but last month, a federal report found that many of them were done improperly. On Friday, Governor Evers asked Attorney General Josh Call to review those mishandled cases. He said it's part of ongoing reforms he's making at the National Guard. In a statement, Evers said, quote, "While it is imperative that we implement these changes that will help prevent sexual assault and harassment in the future, we must also ensure that survivors of sexual assault and harassment see justice served." Attorney General Call said the review would help the Department of Justice, quote, "determine where further investigation and potential prosecution is appropriate." Caitlin Farrell is a public affairs and investigative reporter for the Capital Times. She's been covering this National Guard sexual assault investigation story. Caitlin, thanks for joining us again today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
What do we know about the cases that the Department of Justice is planning to review here?
So really all we know at this point is that these are cases that have been flagged by the National Guard Bureau's Office of Complex Investigation as ones that violated, you know, state and federal Department of Defense and NGB protocol. And so I really, you know, I haven't been able to get any details from the Department of Justice about, you know, the specific circumstances in these cases, but we know that they were ones where they were investigations done internally by Guard commanders, and that they did not follow protocol. And so because of that, there's been a series that the Department of Justice is going to review to kind of look at how they were done.
Can you talk about the shortcomings in those investigations? A lot of this was highlighted in that federal report.
Sure. So basically what we know is that you know, the way that the Department of Defense spells out and the National Guard Bureau spells out the way this should be done is that, you know, if a Guard member reports an allegation of sexual assault, those should be done by a National Guard member that is outside of that individual's chain of command within Wisconsin. Now, in Wisconsin, for the last several years, the former Adjutant General here, Donald Dunbar, was not doing that. And so instead, these types of investigations were done internally. Because of, you know, identifiable information and confidentiality issues, the Department of the Office of Complex Investigations didn't release details of, you know, the specific circumstances of these events. But we know that, you know, there was a way to be doing it, and that for years, the Wisconsin Guard had not been doing it that way.
You've been in touch with the victims of sexual assault and harassment, people who reported these shortcomings and then were in a way re-victimized by these investigations. What are you hearing from them now that we have this review coming from the State Department of Justice?
Yeah, so the ones, the sources that I've heard from, you know, are really thankful for what Governor Evers has done, they've said to me, and happy that there's an acknowledgement that the investigation was really done improperly. I think a common sentiment among many of the folks I've spoken to who've experienced this firsthand is just that, you know, the sexual assault is bad, but what at times can be even worse is the retaliation or finding that the investigation was just done really poorly and was really biased. And so I think that the ones I've spoken to, you know, are happy to hear that they're being reviewed. I know at least one person who I'm in touch with is going to have their case reviewed, but I think the Department of Justice has told me that they're really trying to make this a very victim-centric process. And so it's really up to the victims themselves whether they really want to delve back into this and have the case reviewed. I think, you know, in some cases, folks just really want to move on. And already the investigative process, you know, the first time around can often be a very lengthy thing that can be re-traumatizing and just impede someone from their ability to move on. And so, but yeah, for the most part, you know, I think folks are really happy and hopeful that maybe this can further shed light on a process that's been pretty opaque.
Talking to Caitlin Farrell from the Capital Times, talking about a National Guard sexual assault investigation or investigations. The latest news, Governor Evers and Attorney General Josh Call saying there will be a review of some of these cases that were mishandled by the National Guard, according to a federal report. Caitlin, I know it's still early days. I don't think this review has even started yet, but is there a thought that this could ultimately lead to prosecutions?
Yeah, so my understanding is that this is really the first step in what could be, there could be a series of actions taken from this. I think the Department of Justice's attorneys are going to take a look at what was done. And then I think, you know, if the situation warrants it, I think there's an opportunity for these cases to potentially be reinvestigated and then, as you said, open to prosecution. And so I think they haven't shared really any detail with me about, you know, the likelihood of that happening, but that's a part of what this process is, that all of those things I think are on the table, really depending on what they find and what the circumstances of the case are.
These reviews would address past instances of sexual harassment and assault, but Governor Evers also talking about preventing future ones. Toward that end, earlier this month, Governor Evers hired an ombudsman to oversee future sexual assault investigations at the National Guard. Who is this, and what is their role going to be?
Sure. So this is a position that is actually a federal position, and it's a part of what Governor Evers' executive order, you know, that he released last month. And so his administration, my understanding, is working pretty closely with the National Guard Bureau to, you know, bring in someone from outside of Wisconsin. This is an officer who is still in the Guard, but in the Georgia National Guard, and who has had extensive experience with sexual assaults issues and working with victims there. And so he's actually on federal orders to report to Wisconsin and to take on the role of an ombudsman. And so this is someone who I think can facilitate concerns between folks who are currently serving in the Guard and the Evers administration, and also can, you know, convey and relay any issues as a part of the reforms that Evers has laid out and that the National Guard Bureau has recommended. I think there's going to be more reporting from the Guard we see here as far as progress and specific, you know, initiatives that they're doing so that the public can really understand what they're doing. In addition to the ombudsman, actually, also there's going to be a federal officer that the National Guard Bureau is also sending into Wisconsin. So someone from out of state to really also guide those reforms and make sure that the recommendations are fully implemented. And then furthermore, I know that the Evers administration is currently looking at candidates to replace Donald Dunbar, the former commander. So there'll be a new adjutant general also that I think, and he'd have latitude to make personnel changes and other types of changes within the Guard.
I wanted to ask about that. Is there a timeline for replacing the previous effective commander of the National Guard?
Yeah, so my understanding is Evers had put out a call for applicants. That the deadline for that was earlier this month, so that deadline has passed. And it's my understanding that they are currently reviewing all of the applicants. So there's a process through which there's going to be vetting of those candidates, and then I think an extensive interview process. And so I think there's going to be more to come on that, but it's definitely already underway, and I know that they've already received applications for someone to come in.
Getting back to these reviews of the sexual harassment and sexual assault investigations that we started with, do we know what the timeline is for this review?
No, I really don't. I've asked that question, and I think that you know, I think the Department of Justice is still trying to get a handle on that as well. When I reported that news on Friday, actually, they were still in the process of notifying some of the victims just that their cases kind of were eligible for this type of review. And so I think that the agency is still very much, you know, still very much working with victims to make sure, again, that they have control and that it's a victim-centric process, but no real timeline on how many cases will be reviewed, what those cases are, and how long exactly that review will take.
And Caitlin, you've been watching this story for quite a while now. In our last minute, what are some of the other elements you're watching for next?
So, as you said, yeah, I'm really interested in what's going to happen with the Adjutant General, and also how the other types of reforms that Evers has wanted will take effect. I think that, yeah, it'll be interesting. You know, Donald Dunbar didn't operate in a vacuum. I think there was, you know, there's folks that played a role also in some of the violations that the report highlighted. And so I'm really interested in what types of things are going to happen to make sure that there's real change there.
Caitlin, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
That's Caitlin Farrell, public affairs and investigative reporter at the Capital Times. We talked to her today about the Wisconsin Department of Justice saying it will review and possibly reopen sexual assault and sexual harassment cases from Wisconsin's National Guard. Last month, a federal report found that many of the investigations the Guard conducted were done improperly. A lot of developments since then. This review coming, a new ombudsman appointed, a federal position from out of state, as we heard. And, of course, an ongoing search for a new commander, a new adjutant general of Wisconsin's National Guard. Seltzer water is exploding lately, not literally exploding cans and bottles, I mean, but a lot of companies are getting in on the game. Jelly Belly, makers of jelly beans, one of the latest. Their seltzers are coming to the Midwest soon with predictable flavors like lemon lime and pina colada, not cool jelly bean flavors like toasted marshmallow, buttered popcorn, or strawberry cheesecake. Producer Bill Martins is a fizzy water connoisseur. Hey, Bill.
Hey there.
Now, you drink a lot of seltzer water, fizzy water, sparkling water, whatever we want to call it.
Yeah, usually about one a day. I have one with my lunch. I've got the big 50-ounce bottle that I work on throughout the day, but during lunch, it's nice to have something that has, something different.
A 50-ounce bottle of regular water.
Correct.
Okay, good. Yeah, because that's a lot of carbon. You'd be floating away.
Yeah, it would be.
Now, and you like to experiment with different brands and flavors, I think, right?
Yeah, I mean, I generally go with whatever is cheapest.
Uh-huh.
I mean, to be perfectly fair.
You had a store brand on your desk today with a pretty weak flavor name.
It was like a hint of root beer flavoring. Like, that was the name of the
brand name, a hint of root beer.
Right.
Right. Now, is there a flavor, like, from the jelly bean world that you would want to translate into a seltzer?
You know, I was thinking about this. I think if they wanted to do something unique, they would go with one of those odd flavors. But I just feel like if you take something that isn't overwhelmingly watery to begin with, it's going to be weird, like, you know, the marshmallow or the popcorn.
But you'd try it.
Yeah,
I
probably would try it.
Yeah. And truth in advertising here, you have been thinking about this.
Yes.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.